to just Mr. Jeremy Lake.
Counselor Darling, and ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I would like to say that you must be a very brave audience to come out after all the rude articles we've had about the League of Rights over the last 2 or 3 months, which have, I don't know if it's amazed you, but it's certainly amazed me. I've discovered things about myself that I never knew until I read them in the press. But I'd like to, in view of the sort of rather hysterical campaign that seems to have been raised, make one or two points that I think need emphasizing. Amongst all the accusations that have been leveled against us, there have been two, mainly. The first is that we are strongly anti-Aboriginal. Well, my answer to that, first of all, is it simply is not true. And my own belief is it's been deliberately put in that context to try and stop people looking any further at what we've got to say. And perhaps I could illustrate that by saying that last night I had a meeting 500 miles to the north of here in Wellington, in the centre of New South Wales, where we had all the leaders of the Aboriginal community. And they were in agreement with what I had to say and are themselves very concerned at what is going on. And the night before that, we had a big meeting in Coonabarabran, which is a little further north, and again, we had a large number of Aboriginal people, including all the leaders of their own local community in that area, and again, they were in agreement. And there was a great deal of concern at the political pressure to which they're being subjected. And I wondered why it is that, first of all, what we're saying is not being heard, and secondly, why what so many Aboriginal people are saying is not being heard. In other words, there's a misrepresentation which seems to me very worrying indeed. Now, what I want to try and do tonight is deal with a number of different aspects of the problem that faces. First of all, I want to speak a bit on the Australian Constitution and some of the symbols that are obviously very important to this country, like the crown and the flag, and then to speak partly on the land rights issue and to try and give you a picture of why all these things touch on each other and how important they are. And I suppose the best thing I can do is to try and give you a picture of my own introduction to these issues here in Australia. I'm not born in Australia. I was a migrant here in 1962. But I came from East Africa, and I say that because it's about 1,000 miles north of South Africa, and it's a different part of Africa. I'm always called a South African, but that, again, is one of the inaccuracies you get. And I'd spent all my life there. I was a third generation. My grandparents had gone out there last century. I was a farmer. And I finally was forced to leave after a tremendous political upheaval, which involved four and a half years active service with the British forces during one of the first great guerrilla wars that were fought in that part of the world that seemed to be going on right around the world at the present time. And the reason I came to Australia, and I must confess this with some misgivings, was not because I knew a great deal about Australia, but because I'd heard it was a country that did not have the problems that we were trying to deal with in Africa. It was a country without big racial problems. It was a country that was homogenous. It was a country with a very exciting history. It was a country with tremendous pioneering potential. And that was the place to go. So we tried to find out what we could about it, but we hadn't got very much knowledge. But when I arrived here in 1962, I was quite convinced that I was going to be like a stranger in a new land, having to relearn the whole way of life, and as anyone would going to a country they didn't know too much about. And the thing that staggered me from the moment I got here was not how different it was, but how similar it was to what I'd been used to. So many of the things that happened were identical, and that hit me straight off. It was the last thing I was expecting. There were small, superficial differences. There was obviously a different accent to what I was used to. There was odd phrases that you hear now and again. I heard somebody talking about a fair cow, and I wasn't sure what that was, whether it was a blonde heifer in the fair yards or And then I heard somebody talking about a Bonza Sheila, which was even more peculiar. And then my mother came out 3 months after I did, and she's a very English lady. She's had her education in England, and she came in absolutely horrified one day because the neighbor had told her she'd been in bed with a wog. And we nearly went straight back to Africa on the spot, I might tell you. But it wasn't those little things, it was the similarities. For example, we had an organization in East Africa that was almost identical to the CWA, where we're holding this meeting tonight. It was called the East African Women's League. It was run by the wives of settlers and farmers. They did the same tremendous job over there that they're doing here. Particularly during the last war, they did a tremendous amount for troops overseas. We had a system of local government that was identical to what you've got here in Australia. The interesting thing was that the people who served on local councils did so without pay, mostly. And therefore, it was a genuine form of service. Not only that, but you could talk to them and criticize them without getting put in jail. And that doesn't happen right around the world. If you've got a pothole in the road, you can get hold of a local shire chairman and really belt his ear for him. And you don't get carted off in chains for criticizing the government. Now, that is part of freedom that we just take for granted. But it doesn't happen in quite a lot of parts of the world. You go criticizing government leaders in other parts of the world, it's probably the last thing you do. We had all sorts of similarities, and I kept wondering to myself, how come one part of the world that was so far from another part of the world had the identical system? And I've since discovered it's the same in New Zealand and Canada and, of course, England and often in the United States of America. And obviously it is because we come from a common stream of history. So somebody said, well, if you want to find out how Australia ticks, probably the best starting point would be this book, The Constitution, which is the basic set of rules that the Australian people agreed on right back at the time of Federation as to how their nation was going to be run. So I got hold of a copy of this, which in those days you could get for 2 shillings and 6 pence. It's gone up a bit since then. And the first thing that struck me was it was easy to read. It was written in common sense English, and the people who put this together obviously knew what they were on about. But it also made me realize that this is the most important legal document in the whole of this country, because it is the only set of laws that belong to the people which they can use to control the politicians. We have hundreds and literally thousands of laws pouring out of government from politicians towards ordinary individuals. In fact, far too many. Over the last 5 years, we've had 39,000 new laws in Australia. 39,000. So many that a lot of people can't understand them, including the lawyers. Hasn't made things better, but only one set of laws goes back the other way from the people to the politicians, and that is the Constitution. And it starts with the words, not we, the Prime Minister, or we, the government. It starts with we, the people of New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, Queensland, Tasmania. If you actually look at the list, West Australia is not included in the opening paragraph of the Constitution. Because when we had Federation, West Australia wasn't too sure whether they wanted to come in or not. There was a great argument about whether this was a good move back in 1901. And a lot of people said, look, if we start a new central government, what's to stop that government getting so big that it starts trying to control us all? And West Australia was very reluctant. They didn't come in to begin with. They came in shortly afterwards, and so their name is not in the list. It was finally agreed to have a central government to work in a few limited areas, provided it could be kept under control, and that's why they had a written constitution. So it says, we the people of these various, what were previously colonies. And then it has this important phrase, humbly relying on the blessing of Almighty God. Now, the original draft of the Constitution did not have that in. And the reason it was included was because there was a big campaign run right through Australia in that year, 1901, by Christians of all denominations, Catholic and Protestant, spent a lot of time fighting, but they were agreed on this one point, that there ought to be some reference to God in the way this nation was to be run. So that was included. And it then lays out the nature of government and the limits to politicians. In fact, the whole of this document really says to politicians, now look, there are limits to what you fellows can do. And that's a very good idea. And the most important phrase in this document, I believe, is one which says the politicians can't just change it if they don't agree with it. They've got to go and ask the people first. And there's got to be a referendum of the whole of the Australian people, and they've got to consider the question for any change, and there's got to be a majority of people in a majority of states before one word of this document is changed. And that has been true from 1901 right up until last year in July, when that was shattered. And my own belief is the Constitution now is not almost totally extinct, but is in very great danger. It could be destroyed completely unless something can be done. I'll get on to that in a little while. The second thing I had to try and find out about was the Aboriginal people, because I had come from a reverse situation. I came from a population of 60,000 white people, which is a minute number. It'd be the size of a small suburb down in Melbourne, in a country that had a population of over 7 million different African people in 23 major tribes, all speaking different languages, which had a huge problem. And now I was coming to a country where the great predominating ethnic group, if you want to put it that way, was the white population. In fact, I didn't know very much about the Aborigines, and somebody said, well, if you want to get hold of the details on that, get a hold of the Australian yearbook. So I got hold of the yearbook, and I found out that at that time, in 1961, we had round about 90,000 Aboriginal people. But they weren't just called Aboriginal people in those days. The yearbook used to set it out, and they were divided into different groups. We had Torres Strait Islanders. We had full-blood Aborigines, most of whom lived in the Northern Territory and in Central Australia, and we had what were called mixed blood, or those of mixed parentage. And they were three distinct separate groups. But the total came to round about 90,000, which again is the size of a fairly small suburb in Melbourne. And that is important because with the great arguments going on about Aboriginal land rights and Aboriginal people and laws and customs and sacred sites, often when you ask people, well, how many have we got now in Australia, you find very few people know. From 1961 onwards, we've had a census every 5 years. 1961, 66, 71, 76, 81. And the last census showed that we had 180,000 Aborigines. In other words, it had increased from 90,000 to 180,000. That is a 100% increase in that 20-year period, which is a fantastic increase. It is the fastest rate of increase of any nation in the world. Now, according to Time magazine, looking around the different nations that have growing populations, the country that has the biggest problem is East Africa, again, where I was born. And the fastest growing population in the world is Kenya, with a 3.8% increase annually. 3.8%. That is very frightening. It's a huge increase. Australia is actually going down slightly. The Aboriginal people, during the first 5 years of that census when I came here, grew by 35%. The next 5 years grew by 38%. The following 5 years, it dropped to 12%, and then the last 5 years, it grew by 20%. With an overall increase of around about 100%, and that is absolutely staggering. Now, there are all sorts of reasons being offered for this. Some people say that a large number of Aborigines were too frightened to say that they were Aborigines before, but I don't believe that is true. And if it is true, it's an awful insult to the Aboriginal people, because it suggests that they're so ashamed of their own race that they didn't want to admit what they were. I think really what is happening is that a large number of people are now climbing on a bandwagon that is being deliberately built. And that's another aspect of it. But I think in view of those figures, the current talk, which suggests that the Aboriginal people are in danger of extinction, are being subject to genocide, and some of this is appearing in other parts of the world, are being wiped out, have a huge infant mortality, should be put in its right context. The figures show they're the fastest growing population anywhere in the world at the present time. Second question then is, how much land have they got? Well, over the last 7 or 8 years, there have been very big increases in the area set aside, notably in the Northern Territory, which has been the pattern for all the rest. And at the present time, 12.5% of the whole continent of Australia has been set aside for 180,000 Aboriginal people, which is a fraction over 1% of the total population of Australia. I might just tell you that the Aboriginal community is not the smallest, I beg your pardon, the biggest ethnic minority in this country. For example, we've got nearly 500,000 Asians here now, which is 2.5 times more than Aboriginal people. And I might just tell you that if you look at some of the United Nations conventions which are being used to promote the land rights issue, notably the one coming out of the International Labour Organization, which is always being quoted by Aboriginal leaders in Gough Whitlam, they stipulate in that that land rights apply not just to indigenous people, but other tribal groups. Now, that raises the possibility of the future when other ethnic minorities can also seek land rights under United Nations treaties. And my own belief is that while it's not being discussed now, the time will come when we hear new arguments raised, why shouldn't Vietnamese have land? They have an affinity with the land. They've been robbed of their country by the refugee crisis. Wouldn't it be reasonable to have land rights for them as well? And if we're going to resort to United Nations treaties for those sort of arguments, well, we'll probably have to say yes in that particular situation. I remember about 3 years ago, I was lecturing only a few miles from here over the other side of Wodonga, a small country meeting round about this size, and we had, at that meeting, we had a very distinguished-looking Sikh in the audience with a turban on from Northern India and a big black beard. And I was talking to him afterwards, and I asked him why he'd be interested. He was a teacher at the local high school. Why he'd be interested in a political meeting in a rural area. Oh, he said, I'm always interested in politics. And I asked him what he did. He said, apart from teaching, he happened to be the Australian representative of the Palestine Liberation Organization, which nearly floored me because I didn't know such a thing existed. So I asked him how many supporters and members he had, thinking there might have been a couple of hundred. Oh, he said, last count, Mr. Lee, around about 70,000 in Australia. And I nearly fell backwards. I said, I had no idea there were 70,000 Mohammedans in Australia. And he just laughed. He said, Mr. Lee, we've got 90,000 in Sydney alone. So I began to realize that the problem of race was already a very big problem and could not simply be swept under the carpet by trying to pretend it didn't exist. So 12.5% of Australia has been set aside for the Aborigines in a situation which now is coming under legislation which prohibits Australians of any other race going in there on penalties of fairly big fines. But it hasn't stopped there, because 1/4 of the continent is now under claim, and if those are granted, 1/4 of the whole of Australia will have gone. And if you look at the map of where the land claims lie, they stretch from the Gulf of Carpentaria in an almost unbroken belt right through the centre, almost down to the Great Australian Bight. So the defence implications and the communication implications should be considered. You go to states like Western Australia, where at the present time, although the National Aboriginal Conference has put in a claim for the whole state at one stage, the whole state, it's now been reduced down to half. The Aboriginal population of West Australia is just on 30,000 people, and they want half the state. Down here in Victoria, as you know, there's been the argument about the Victorian Land Claims Bill, with all that went on, 37% of the state eligible for claim, with arguments about whether this is going to include private property or not, the government denying that it is, but nevertheless claims being made by the Aboriginal Lands Council that this is on. But in the argument, when you start asking the question, how many Aboriginal people are there in Victoria, you find very few people know, and the most ignorant often seem to be the Aboriginal people. One Aboriginal leader at a meeting in Ballarat told me there were 14,000 minimum here in Victoria. But the last census shows fraction under 8,000, which is a minute, it's a small village, now eligible to claim 37% of the state. So that is the situation surrounding land rights, and then on top of that, on top of the controversy that we've had in the Northern Territory, where at the present time 28% of the whole Northern Territory has been granted to the Aboriginal people, with another 14% under claim, and a tremendous friction building up that really has got to be seen to be believed in centres like Alice Springs and Catherine and Tennant Creek, where there is a bitter division now between black and white which didn't used to exist in this country. And the accusation is made by those who have pushed those people into that situation that they are responsible. In other words, government creates legislation which puts people at each other's throats and then points the finger at those people and calls them racist. Whereas in actual fact, it is the legislation which has created that situation rather than the people themselves. That is not to say there haven't been injustices. There have been injustices, and I think they've got to be sorted out, but not certainly by centrally directed legislation on the way we're having at the present time. So that is the situation, and then on top of that has come the bill which I believe is going to create the greatest argument of all, and that is the new federal bill, which has been produced by Clive Holding, the Federal Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, under the situation. Clive Holding, when he got in, and the Hawke government, when they got in, said, we are determined there is going to be legislation and land rights within the first term of Parliament. We hope the states will do it. And they said to all the state governments, you have got to introduce land rights legislation, and if you don't do it up to standards, we're going to bring our own in on top of you. And that is the reason, willy-nilly, the Victorian government moved rather hastily to introduce their land claims bill. That is the reason the RAN government in New South Wales has pushed through legislation, incidentally, against the wishes of the Aborigines. And the story in New South Wales has got to be heard to be believed, because the Attorney General, Mr. Frank Walker, went to the leaders of the Aboriginal community and said, we are determined you are going to have land rights. We want you to come up in a short period of time with a list of the claims and the areas that you want, and we would like your response within a couple of months. And the response from the Aboriginal leaders to the New South Wales government was, we want this held up for at least 2 years, but as we're not decided, this is what we want. And the New South Wales government said, you're going to have it whether you like it or not. You're going to have it whether you like it or not. So at the meetings we had last night in Wellington and in Coonabarabra and the night before, the majority of the Aboriginal leaders were rather against land rights. They do want a bit of land to build their homes on, but this concept of land rights, there is a growing reaction amongst the Aboriginal people which the media will not mention. It won't touch it, and yet it is there. It is not true to say the Aboriginal people are united in their desire for what is now being done. Well, apparently, the states were moving very slowly. The Queensland government, which is painted as a reactionary, McCarthyist, fascist, government, the sort of government that could almost be controlled by the League of Rights, they say, has said that they're not going to move and the federal government can go and whistle, and so the federal government has now introduced the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders Heritage Interim Protection Bill, which went through with enormous controversy and has now earned the opposition of bodies right throughout the country. It's earned the opposition of the National Farmers Federation, which is normally very reluctant to get involved in political issues. It's earned the opposition of the Australian Mining Industry Council, the Chamber of Mines in Western Australia, the United Graziers up in Queensland, the Pastoralists and Graziers in West Australia. Body after body after body has come out and said this is atrocious legislation. And to show you how atrocious it is, two things have now happened. The first is the ALP in West Australia has come out against the bill. That is their own party. And the second thing is, and this is the ultimate, Mr. Peacock has come out against it. And if Mr. Peacock comes out against anything at all, it must be absolutely hairy. And so, we've got to ask the question, what does this bill say? Well, if you listen to what the government is saying, it has done the most despicable thing. It has produced an act, and then it is trying to quieten people down with verbal assurances. And the verbal assurances it has given the National Farmers Federation are these. We are not going to claim any private land in Australia. No private land at all. And we will consult Cabinet before any claims are made. So you pick up the bill hoping to find that something of that nature is in there, and there is not one word about that in the legislation itself. And if you actually read the legislation, it is quite specific that any area of Australia can be claimed. There is not one exemption under this bill. It does not say we will exempt private land. It does not say freehold land will not be claimed. It says any area of Australia and Australia's territorial waters, land, sea or air, may be claimed and frozen. And to go further, there is a whole section in the bill which deals with compensation for private owners who have been deprived of their property. Now, why do you put a section in a bill talking about compensation to people who've been deprived of property if you have no intention of claiming that property in the first place, according to their verbal assurances? And my own view is, But once we start neglecting to look at the legislation and simply looking at the lips of the people who push it through the parliament, we are in deep trouble. Because it's not the verbal assurances which are translated into law, it is the bills that go through parliament. So the only way to deal with it is to get the bill and look at what it says. And it says any area of Australia can be frozen under two claims. Any Aboriginal can make a claim on any area, object, site. If the minister agrees and he is the arbiter, that is frozen under two declarations. The first one is an emergency declaration, and it is frozen for 30 days, and if he wants to extend it to 60 days, he can. But then there is a normal claim or a normal declaration under which he can freeze it for as long as he wishes. And the penalties for anybody who then infringes that law are absolutely horrific. A $10,000 fine, or 5 years in jail, or both, for any individual, or $50,000 for any company that is involved in that action. Well, you say, is there any provision in the bill where perhaps a claim is made, say, for a farm, or an area, or a park, and it's under contention? In other words, there is conflicting evidence. Some people say it is a sacred site. Some people say it isn't a sacred site. Is the provision that this can be examined by an independent examiner and determined according to the rules of evidence? No, there is not. Once the minister has decided that the claim will go through, his decision is taken as evidence that that is a sacred site, whether in fact it is or not. So there is absolutely no provision for any contesting. Under legal contestment, the normal sort of legal provisions which you think would apply in any provision of this bill. And my own belief is it is absolutely atrocious and should be redrafted or rejected. And that is the bill that I think they're going to see screwed down after the election. It's going to be kept very quiet until after this next election is over. But after that, we have a period in which the Aboriginal provision, which is supposed to be an interim bill, will then become a final bill. And if you look at, start looking at what has happened, where in West Australia 750,000 sacred sites have now been listed, New South Wales has started the listing process and at the moment is up to 12,000 sacred sites, with a whole lot more in the pipeline. And the frightening thing to me is there's an article in today's Sydney Morning Herald on what is happening there. The Aboriginal people are happy with the 12,000. But the Department of Aboriginal Affairs, which is run by whites, is not. They're going to list a whole lot more because they think the Aboriginals must have forgotten. And under one of the headings for the areas which they're going to list are what they call mythological sites, where nothing exists at all. There is no sacred site. There is no particular building or relic or anything of Aboriginals, but something in their past makes it significant. They might have had a meeting there, or they might have crossed swords there. That can be listed even though there's nothing on the site at all. And they call that mythological sites, which can now be listed on the map. It really is quite ridiculous. So my own belief is this is being forced upon the Australian people, including the Aboriginal people, against the wishes of a large number of both groups, and has got to be looked at very carefully. But my main concern, and to me the most interesting feature of the whole of the great battle we've had over land rights throughout Australia over the last 3 or 4 months, the one aspect that is not touched, is never mentioned in the press, never comes up in a television interview, is never mentioned publicly at all, is the real danger, which is the move to take these Aboriginal areas out of Australia altogether and turn them into separate areas. And so I'd like to show how that is being done and how it links in with the Constitution, because it ties in with the attack on the Constitution. So we've got to move back to the Constitution. We were talking about the importance of this and how it came under the control of the people. Right through Australia's history, there has been a battle between politicians who want more power, because politicians hate the rules. Every politician would like more power, and the Constitution is a nuisance which gets in the way, and the people. So we've had referendum after referendum after referendum, and in most cases, the people have said no to more power in Canberra. Occasionally, after a lot of consideration, they say yes. I think about 5 or 6 cases, but the great majority no. And it came to a head during the war, when we had an Attorney General here in Australia who was determined that the war gave us the chance to get rid of the Constitution by subterfuge. His name was Dr. Evatt, the famous Dr. Evatt. He's the model for Senator Gareth Evans and Lionel Murphy. And during the war, that Attorney General went round all the state governments, Tasmania, Queensland, Victoria, New South Wales, etc., and he said to those states, look, we've got a war on. We need a lot of power in Canberra. Would you be prepared to hand all your state powers into Canberra just for the duration of the war? As soon as the war's finished, you'll get them back. And because the war was on, and it sounded a good argument, every state agreed to that move. Every state, with the exception of one state, which was Tasmania, the smallest state. And even down there, it was only the upper house that wouldn't go along with it. If they could have got every state to agree, we could have had simultaneous legislation and the whole power structure of Australia would have shifted to Canberra. But that one little house in Tasmania held it back and came under great attack. It was attacked in the press for being anti-war effort and too conservative and fuddy-duddy, but they wouldn't budge. And in fact, the leader of the upper house, when he was asked by Everett to agree, said, look, why are you asking me? You know the government of Tasmania doesn't belong to me. Go and ask the people it belongs to, the ordinary people. If they say yes, they're prepared to shift the power to Canberra. I won't argue with you. And Dr. Everett said, well, how am I supposed to ask then? Well, he said, it's in the Constitution. You have a referendum, and you just ask the people to vote yes or no. That's all you've got to do. If you want the power in Canberra, go through that. Well, he didn't want to do that, because the people always voted no. He was hoping to get round it another way. So finally, in 1944, they had to have a referendum. And the referendum was held, and it was a famous referendum known as the 14 Powers Referendum. And the Labour Party sought the shifting of 14 major powers from the states to go to Canberra, and by that time a lot of people had woken up. There was a young lawyer called Bob Menzies, going round holding meetings in the bush. They used to come and talk to you face to face then. None of this photogenic stuff over television. Politicians used to at least get their hands dirty and meet the people, and get up on tree stumps and soap boxes and talk to people. He said, for goodness sake, don't let Federation go. There was a dairy farmer from the North Coast in New South Wales called Anthony, Larry Anthony, Doug Anthony's father, was lecturing in Australia at that time. There was a tremendous grazier from New England called Dave Drummond, one of the real old-school country parties. He knew what it was all about. Don't let the Constitution and Federation go. We had a railway worker from North Queensland called Artie Fadden, was warning people, don't let it happen. So when the referendum was held, there was a huge vote, no, right throughout Australia. Biggest vote of the whole lot was in Tasmania. And only one group of Australians voted for the referendum, yes. And this is an interesting story. They were the troops fighting overseas. Now, the reason they voted yes was because they couldn't read the local papers. They didn't read the speeches of Artie Fadden and Menzies and others warning about what was really happening. They got a little newsletter, came out from the Australian Army Educational Service, which happened to be left-wing controlled. And one of the key men writing that little newsletter was a young fellow called Dr. Jim Chan. Ever heard of him? And they had a simple argument. This would help the war effort. Everybody in Australia is basically sympathetic. You vote yes too, so without thinking too much about it, the majority of soldiers voted for it. But the national vote held it back. And at that time, we had the move which is now ringing in Victoria and through the west of Australia. Because Dr. Everett realized they would never get round the Constitution by asking the people. And he got together with a young, very clever socialist bureaucrat who'd been in charge of a department called the Department of Post-War Reconstruction, called Dr. Margaret Coombs, who incidentally has recently been on the head of the Aboriginal Treaty Committee. And Dr. Coombs and Dr. Everett got together and they said, look, we have to work out subterfuge. There are two ways we could get around the Constitution. First one is through local councils. If we could persuade all the local councils in Australia to amalgamate into regional governments, and we give these regional governments more and more money from Canberra, and the money we give the regional governments from Canberra, we'll cut off from the state governments. Over a period of time, what will happen will be the states will gradually wither and grow weaker and weaker, and these regional governments will take on more and more responsibilities, and finally, they'll be doing the whole job, but regional governments have no protection under the Constitution at all. They'll be under our control in Canberra. Very clever. So the first documents written on amalgamating councils, which, as you know, Mr. Kane and previously his predecessor have been pushing in Victoria, were written by Dr. Coombs back in 47 and 48. The other point which Dr. Everett brought up was that the Constitution contains, under Section 51, two little words. The Commonwealth Government is given power over external affairs. Now, when the Constitution was written, the United Nations didn't even exist, hadn't even been dreamt of. All it meant was the Commonwealth had power over foreign policy, defense, our relationship with other nations. But Dr. Everett, in his wily way, thought if we can get that interpreted to mean that if we sign international treaties with other countries, we could use that to bring laws into Australia over the top of the Constitution, why, we've got the whole thing in the bag. So Dr. Coombs started on local government. Dr. Everett left Australia, went to the United Nations, was one of the architects of its convention, became the president of it in its early days. And the whole Constitution might have been finished back in the late 40s had not it been for the fact that the Labour Party got thrown into the wilderness in 1949 by Menzies and Fadden. And in came a Liberal Country Party government, which at least sounded a bit more reasonable, and the whole of that package of regional government and international treaties was just put in a big bag, and the fridge door was opened, and they put it in the back of the deep freeze and slammed the door, and that was the end of that. Well, time went by. Menzies retired. McEwen retired. Artie Fadden retired. We had a succession of rather dismal prime ministers. We had Harold Holt for a short while. We had Sir William McMahon. We had John Gorton. We had all the knives coming out of the Liberal Party. They became complacent in office. They became corrupt. And finally, in 1972, they were booted out, and in came the exciting Mr. Gough Whitlam and his merry men. And they simply opened the fridge door and brought out the package and put it on the table and opened it up and just carried on where Everett and Dr. Coombs had finished off. And two things happened. We had Mr. Lionel Murphy started on international conventions. We had a gentleman called Mr. Tom Uren started on local government. And they started a department in Canberra called the Department of Urban and Regional Development and a Commonwealth Grants Commission, and they sent nice little gilt-edged invitations to every councillor in Australia, come to a big party in Canberra, and they laid out the red carpet and had tea and bicky, and old bushies from North Queensland and West Australia came out of Canberra. Some of them had never been there before. And were they given tea and sympathy? The government was all over them. Look, we'll help you much more than the state government. We'll give you more money. Just put in applications. We'll give you the Australian Assistance Plan, and we'll give you red schemes, and we'll give you this, and we'll give you that. Would you just consider forming into regional government? Not much to ask. And we had councillors coming back to Queensland. Perhaps your councillors were wider awake than ours, saying, look, you know, this Whitlam's a pretty good bloke. He's going to give us more money. And the first meetings we had on regional government in Queensland were actually pushed by the Liberal Country Party. They thought it was terrific. They had no idea where it had come from. So that started. But 3 years was enough, and people began to see that the whole place was being turned upside down, and so in that crisis, Whitlam got thrown out. And we had Mr. Fraser and Doug Antony went round, and they said, look, we won't have any more of the socialism. Put us in. We'll fix it up. We'll reduce your taxes, you might remember, and we'll get people back to work, and we'll decentralize power. We'll have a new federal system, and small industry will be put back in its feet. And people said, thank goodness for that. And they put Fraser and Antony in and went fast asleep. They went into hibernation. And nobody noticed that the program which Whitlam had carried on with was never put back in the fridge. It was never put back in the fridge. The Liberal Country Party government just continued with exactly the same program. And the Human Rights Commission bill, which Mr. Lionel Murphy couldn't get through, was pushed through by the Fraser government. It was the Fraser government that signed the World Heritage Commission Act that put Tasmania and the Franklin Dam into operation. It was not the Whitlam government. And I'm sorry to say they betrayed everything they stood for. And the most sickening hypocrisy to me was when poor little Tasmania was put into the dock for building a dam. Under the Constitution, it's entitled to do that. The man who went down there on whatever it is, $5,000 a day to defend Tasmania in the High Court when they had a High Court case, was Mr. Bob Ellicott, who'd been the Attorney General who actually signed the treaty that put them in the dock in the first place. And finally, it all came to a head. And people finally, in 1982, began to sense that the Fraser government was not honoring its promises. We were back on the same road. Taxes were going through the roof. More and more power being centralized. And in came an exciting new gentleman called Mr. Hawke in March 83, and we had the Tasmanian Dam thing, which has put us in the most frightful situation. Now, let's just analyze what happened in that Tasmanian Dam decision. Most people see it simply as a conservation argument. Are you for the dam or against the dam? People have hot opinions about that, though they haven't even been there, and 90% of them aren't too sure where the Franklin River is exactly. If you get them a map of Tassie and said, draw it in, they wouldn't be too certain. But nevertheless, they're experts on conservation. But a state wanted to build a dam. We've had hundreds of dams built right throughout Australia, all built under this document called the Constitution. And the clause they build it under is Clause 100. And Clause 100 reads as follows. The Commonwealth shall not, by any law or regulation of trade or commerce, abridge the right of a state or of the residents therein to the reasonable use of the waters of rivers for conservation or irrigation. Now, you couldn't get it much clearer. The Commonwealth shall not interfere with the state over rivers, bluntly. So, Mr. Hawke said the dam would not go ahead, and Tasmania said, well, who's going to stop us? Mr. Hawke said, I'm going to. Well, they said, you can't stop us, and they read the Constitution. Now, it says under the Constitution we're allowed to do it. He said, I don't care what the Constitution says. I've now got new powers. Oh, where did you get them? From the Australian people? No, I got them from the United Nations. They said, I can stop you. Well, they said, we'll have to see about this. And they went to the High Court, and the High Court was split right down the middle. The Chief Justice of Australia and two fellow judges said, if that goes through, the Constitution is finished. Four judges, including Mr. Lionel Murphy, said, well, you know, international treaties are very progressive these days. Perhaps we better be with it. So by one vote, a decision was made that if you sign an international treaty, you can scrub out that clause in the Constitution you want to scrub out. And forget about the Tasmanian dam. It opened the gate to 1,500 international treaties, which are now beginning to come in. They're coming in one after the other. Human rights commissions, anti-sex discrimination commissions, new commissions and conventions on the rights of parents or what no rights parents have. They have just about everything now under a new legal system coming in through the United Nations. And using that, we have now got the real argument about Aboriginal land rights. Because with 12.3% of Australia already completely granted to the Aborigines, nobody else is allowed in there, another quarter under claim, the head of the Aboriginal Legal Affairs Department, Mr. Paul Coe, who is a public servant financed by you, the taxpayer, has gone to the United Nations, and he's gone to the Human Rights Commission, and he said, look, I want your assistance to take a case to the International Court of Justice. The International Court of Justice is supposed to sit on international cases and is not supposed to interfere in the domestic affairs of nations. But nevertheless, they're looking at new conventions, and the new conventions are land rights for indigenous people. Now, already it has been decided in the United States